a Motorsport Podcast Network production. Hey everybody, Aaron Noonan, great to have you with me. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. Of course, Repco is driven by passion, so are we. Celebrating their 100th anniversary this year, visit repco.com.au. Now, my guest on the podcast this week is a guy who, well, he deliberately, as he describes in this chat, moves in the shadows. He's not one seeking the limelight, and that's why you really haven't heard a great deal from him, and that's exactly why I wanted to get him on the podcast. Sven Burkarts is the team co-owner of Tickford Racing. He's partners with Rod Nash in that squad. He's a long-time motorsport competitor in terms of Porsche racing. He's raced in TCM. He's raced in Australian GT. He created the Porsche GT3 Cup Challenge. It is now the Porsche Michelin Sprint Challenge. It's the second tier to Carrera Cup. He's got a really unique lens of Australian motorsport as a competitor, as a team co-owner, but also as a lawyer, because that's his day job, and he deals a lot with motorsport, motoring, and automotive-related matters. So I thought this was a good chance to have a chat to a guy who, A, has great stories, B, is a great chat, and C, you haven't heard a great deal about. And that's one of the things we love to do with this podcast, is to inform you, tell you some things, or open you up to people who you probably haven't heard of before, or you haven't heard much from or about. And you can learn some more and gain some more insight. That's what we're all about on the V8 Sleuth Podcast. So buckle up, sit back, relax, and enjoy Sven Burkarts on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Sven, this is the first time I've ever done a V8 Sleuth Podcast in a lawyer's office. I feel like I'm in trouble, but I'm not, am I?
That's right. No, you're safe in my hands, Aaron. just be comfortable. This won't hurt a bit,
yeah,
as they say.
I've heard that before. Mate, we've got so much to talk about because there's so many elements of your involvement in motorsport as a competitor, as a partner in Tickford Racing. Where's the motorsport car thing come from for you? We know you for your Porsche racing and a bit of TCM and partner in Tickford, but where does this all go back to?
My mother.
It's her fault.
It's her fault. She is. She was a motorsport fan from the get-go. So the first Porsche I ever saw was my mum had borrowed her boss's old orange 911, and for the weekend saying, look, can I drive this? What she didn't tell him was that she'd entered into a ADAC tarmac rally and and competed.
When was this?
Well, this was late 60s, and so I was 6 or 7, and so she's done this, come back, and I remember seeing this Porsche come in, and then Mum went away for the weekend, and Mum came back, and the Porsche disappeared, and that was the end of it. Until a few years later, she told me about it, and she won, and she got the gold medal, and and in fact, the gold medal came out in 2007. It had been sitting in her drawer for a while, because when I won the Porsche Cup or the Porsche Drivers Challenge in Australian GT, she said, I think it's time that I gave you my gold medal. So she came out. So she's the reason for the motorsport interest. She, when I was 14, she did something completely illegal and let me drive her Toyota Corolla station wagon down.
What a beast.
Oh, yeah. No, 1,200 cc's of raw power, Aaron. that got my head into cars. And I remember the first car magazine I bought was a 1974 Modern Motor and had a 930 turbo on the cover. And it was actually on the same trip that Mum let me drive the Corolla. So I thought, white Corolla wagon, white 930, join the dots.
There's
something to aim for. So, yeah, it's her fault. She's a crazy motorsport person. She lives down the island. So for a lot of years, hosted and had MotoGP teams staying at her house.
Oh, gold.
And they'd take her to the track and she'd, you know, be mum to them. And, you know, she goes and she still stays up and watches all the Formula One Grand Prix. And she's 85. So,
good effort.
So, yeah, I think
some of those are really late. I don't even sit up for those.
Nah, she's not got a lot to do, Aaron. Like, seriously.
But that's okay. That's still commitment to the motorsport task.
She absolutely loves it. Rings me up and goes, oh, did you see? Nah.
I was in bed.
Yeah, and I haven't caught up yet, Mum, but yeah, tell me what happened.
What was the first race car, first road car before that?
So, my first road car, keeping on the theme of raw power, it was a It was a Toyota Celica, 1974 Toyota Celica, a white one. That was great. And I was working at a servo at the time, so I had the opportunity to fiddle with it. So when I blew the motor up, as you inevitably do as a young man, I went down to the wreckers and bought a Toyota Corona 2-litre, which I inexpertly shoved in the front, and it was a bit tall, so I had to ease the bonnet up with a hammer to get the carby to clear. But that was the first car, and I loved it. Actually, I spent 3 years saving up for it. I started working at a servo when I was 15 and got my license on my 18th birthday. Mum had bolted the P plate on. She was a confident woman. and so that was the first car.
And just going back, did the boss – I forgot to ask this before. Did the boss ever know what happened with the Porsche?
No. No, mum's a bit cagey.
I love it. It's the best story I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, that's my mum. She's a bit of a unit.
So how do you go from working the servo to getting on a path to law?
Well, I needed to fund my law degree. So so I had to work full time. So once I kept working at the servo for about 3 years, but at the same time I worked at the local pub. So I got to know everyone local because everyone has to buy beer and everyone has to buy petrol.
True.
So, yeah, I kept working and the servo was good to me. And then when I was 21, sort of 2 years out from it, I stopped, just worked at the pub.
And whereabouts is this? Where'd you grow up?
Emerald, up in the Dandenong Ranges. Yeah. So lived there since the mid-70s and then continued to live there after I did all that. But, that actually fueled my real interest in cars because the boss was really good to me. He let me work on my car or the cars because I have a habit of changing them with monotonous regularity. So the car after that was another Celica, and then I went big and I bought the Falcon GXL vinyl black roof gold. But it got the Genie extractors, the drop pipes.
It got stuff.
The 12 slotters, the 650 Holley double pumper. Yeah, because I worked at a servo, so I got a good deal on the petrol, so I didn't care. You know? So at that point I wasn't an environmentalist because it consumed copious amounts of petrol.
And tell me about the law. I hate the word. It sounds so reality TV. The law journey is sort of – I can't frame it any other way, but you're at Kaliskini Intellects now. Yeah. How have you – we've got heaps of motorsport to talk about, but I'm interested in this side of it because it all blends together.
Yeah.
But how do you end up going from studying – I have never studied law, will never study law. What's the process and how do you end up where you're sitting today?
So, I went the law journey actually started in year 11 when I did legal studies. And for my mind I've got an aptitude for it, the way it thinks, the way I – solve problems. So I got interested in law when I was in year 11 and did year 12, and that really coloured how I dealt with year 12, because back then you had to get a reasonable – and like now, I suppose – get some reasonable marks to get in. So I worked like a lunatic during year 12, basically shut myself off from the world for 12 months to get the marks that I thought I needed to get, which I was lucky enough to get. I went to Monash. I could have got into Melbourne, but Monash was down the road from where I lived, so it was an easier commute because I was still working. So I couldn't go into Melbourne and then come back and work. So 5 years at Monash. I did 2 law degrees at the time, and then you go out and you're effectively an article clerk, which is an apprentice. So you do a year at a law firm doing your articles. It's now called traineeship. You get your ticket and then they let you loose on the world, which is probably the scariest thing that ever happens to a 23-year-old because at that stage you know 3/5 of the proverbial and you're seriously dangerous. You shouldn't be giving legal advice as a 23-year-old, but you get to, which is a bit odd. But I had very good supervisors. I did a year or two doing pretty heavy criminal law work. I left the firm that I was at and ended up working at a firm that did a lot of pretty heavy crime, which was the best thing ever happened because I was green as grass after my articles year, and that sort of drummed the naivety out of me. Came back to my firm that I actually did my articles with and was there for effectively a total of 23 years. In 2011 I left thought about retiring, had the ability to, but, you know, at 48, seriously, you've got a bit of gas in the tank. So I took 3 or 4 days off and started my own practice. Which
the
is
whole 3 or 4 days?
Whole that's three all. Or four days. it was 30th of June because that's when you finish your partnership. Had the rest of the week off. I'd already organised an office. That's where the Intellex comes from. Because a mate of mine, he and I went to the Royal Saxon, I think it's called the Royal Saxon in Richmond,
yep.
And 14 million beers in, came up with a name and a business plan. And so I had a pretty solid restraint after I left that firm. But my journey was basically I was a disputes lawyer, litigation lawyer, and still am, do a lot of that. Ended up running a really big team. And as you do, relationships and things change. So I left. They wrote me a big check. They said, now you only can do this for 3 years. I said, that's fine. That's all I want to do. I met Henry and Jonathan through a mutual contact, and in 2013 we created this place. Mm. And the where I was, we built it from 80 people to 370 inside probably 6 or 8 years, and I'd had enough of a really big business, so I was determined to see if we could do something really cool with a boutique, no more than 40, maybe 50 people, and we've managed to achieve that. So it sounds easy, but it's fun. I still love what I do. I really enjoy it.
Part of that boutique element is the motorsport connection. Yep. So what sort of stuff do people in motorsport come to you with? I mean, when you think about it, quite often people go, lawyer, motorsport, contract disputes, negotiate. But it's drivers, it's teams, it's series, it's manufacturers, it's sponsorship deals, it's contract. Like, there's a long list of stuff here, and that's why if you boutique, you know, for a certain area and you can specialise in it, there's plenty of stuff around. Because
there's
always someone in motor racing disagreeing with somebody else.
It's the beauty of the sport, isn't it, Aaron?
Yes.
but the reality is motorsport is a business, and it's also a hobby, it's also a passion, and it can be all three for some people. So the motorsport side of things is driven by my passion for it. So I got into it in the late 90s because I was doing reasonably well and thought, you know, I pushed my way into partnership just before I was 30 and decided to reward myself. So I bought an earlier 911 and went out to a track day, had a bit of fun. 6 weeks later, the guts was hanging out of it. The suspension was being done, the brakes, and, you know, it's been a roller coaster since then. But the reason I do a lot of motorsport is because I do a lot of work for people in business and people associated with it. And like anything, people want to deal with people who have got a similar interest, who they share some connection with and who gets the industry. So, you know, I've been right through the club system, then started doing a race GTs, ran the GT3 Cup Challenge or Sprint Challenge as it was for 3 years. And the reason people come to you is because they don't need to educate you. So, for instance, if somebody's in front of the stewards or the appeal process in CAMS, or as it then was, it's always good to know that the person that's working for you has also been down the same roads. I've spent some quality time in the stewards' room. Now, I have been down the odd appeal.
Know exactly what it feels like.
100%. I know what you're going through because, when you do as much motorsport as I have, there's the affinity. And people come to you saying, look, I don't need to educate you. I don't need to tell you what subregs are. I don't need to tell you what driver contracts are. I don't need to tell you how to structure a sponsorship deal or negotiate one. So a lot of the work that I do actually isn't about disputes, and it really isn't. The work that I do is far more constructive than that. It's about, you know, employment law, hiring drivers, hiring mechanics, hiring the person who drives the truck, right through to buying things, buying assets, buying and selling teams. I act for some people overseas. I act for a lot of people locally. But motorsport, it's because I know it and people know that I know it. So generally they come to me. I mean, I don't do all the motorsport work in Australia at all.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do get to do is just really, really enjoyable.
How did you end up becoming a part owner of Tickford Racing? Because when people think of that team, of course, it was FPR, Pro Drive, Tickford Racing.
Yep.
Clearly, there was a sale. I think it's pretty much 10 years next year, I think it is, that Rod Nash and Rusty French became involved. How did you get involved in all that, and why did you get involved in all that?
So that's an example of what I just said. So I get this call. I'm in my little practice, just me and one lawyer, after I've left the old place, and the phone rings. And, well, it actually happened this way. I first met Rod and Tim Edwards when Reynolds was exiting Kelly's, which wasn't terribly pleasant.
I do recall that, yeah.
I had to manage that very carefully. There was obviously some people quite annoyed and some people who wanted him. So I dealt with that for David, and we managed that quite carefully. And I was very, very open and very direct with Rod and Tim as to what I was prepared to do and what David was safely able to do. So that was the introduction, but they were on the other side, and you know, that happened, and it worked for a while. But as a result of that, I got a call out of the blue, 2012, I think it is, saying, oh, it's Rod Nash here. Yep, how you going? Good. And I thought, shit, there's a problem with Dave. And no, it wasn't. He tells me, yep, there's the opportunity to buy it. And, you know, here's the deal. This is parameters. Can you help put it together? They've done all the contracts, so we just want you to handle our side of the transaction and also help put the relationship documents between Rusty and Rod together. So did that. It was actually a fun time because at the same time I got a call out of the blue from a guy who was working at Erebus, and it was when Betty bought the Stones out. So I was running both transactions at the same time.
It's all going on.
It's all going on. Like it from you know, from zero to hero inside sort of 2 months. But what was interesting was I got to compare the transactions and how they were being managed and how they were being run and all the DD. For instance, Rod had been a part and a customer of FPR forever, so he didn't have to do much DD. He knew how the joint ran.
And DD is due diligence.
Yes, due diligence, right. So, but it was a different thing for Betty. This was a new thing for her. So, you know, I went up. It was actually the Gold Coast round. I went up there a few days earlier and sat down with the Stones and went through the due diligence process. But yeah, it was. I remember ringing Rod up about something. I said, "Listen, I know you got good lawyers. Why'd you come to me?" And he goes, "Well, because I don't have to educate you. You know, you're 80-90% down the road. You know how recs work. You know how driver contracts work. You know how sponsorship agreements work. You know all of that sort of stuff. So it's a no-brainer." Mm. So anyway, I did that deal, and Rod said, "Sit on the advisory board with us." And I did help them out. Just talked to them about, you know, the running the business governance and someone. And Rod's always really been good to try and get people around him that can help him think. So that's what I did. And in 2015, he rang out of the blue and said, "Oh, listen, we know you've been going through this ownership thing. We've been talking, and do you want to own a slice?" And I've gone, "Yeah, right."
You know, that easy.
Yeah. I thought, oh, I better talk to my wife. So I told her that I'd done the deal as opposed to was thinking about doing the deal. It was always
so safer. Beg for forgiveness rather than seek permission.
It's worked my entire life.
Right? Like, why change now?
Yeah, when you're on a good thing, as they say. So so that's what happened. And that's when I became an owner. I was actually looking at this yesterday because I thought this question might come up. So it was around April 2015 that it all started to happen, I think.
And now we're in 2022, so it's pretty much 7 years.
Yep.
So what do you – are you passive? Are you hands-on? Are you when they need you, what's your role at Tickford? Because I think a lot of our listeners and supercar fans, when they think of Tickford Racing owner, they probably think Rod first,
yep.
Rusty second, and then a few people go – who's the other guy?
Yeah.
So what's are you deliberately in the background a little bit more? Or what's the scenario?
Yeah, look, the answer is I've always been passive. The fact is that between Rod and Tim and the management team, both commercial and racing, they know exactly what they're doing, right? So mine is not deliberately more anonymous, but I've got no business telling them how to do their thing. I talk to Rod about, you know, the future of the business, how we structure it, opportunities. So I am involved in all the major decisions. But as far as the sporting and the commercial customer sponsor-facing stuff, that's not for me. I mean, the odd person comes through me if I introduce someone. But yeah, certainly, and when Rusty was an owner, because he's not anymore. He was also very supportive of Rod and had great connections. So it worked and still works very cohesively. So, you know, I turn up to the odd race meeting, but really I've got nothing to offer, seriously. If I look at cars,
they go slow. Yeah,
let's just do those rear springs, mate, because you know, if there's anyone that's got an ability to tune speed out of a car, it's me.
Hey, it's a great skill.
100%.
There's a lot of people around with that ability.
Now that my boys are karting, they just will not let me near it.
Smart boys already. Yeah, Smart boys already.
They've cottoned on fast. So, yeah, my involvement is very active within the business, but outside it's not something I seek. You know, people know, but it happens by osmosis rather than, you know, trumpeting it at, you know, the fact that I'm a part owner is buried on the website, and if people go that far, they're probably bored. really what I want for the business is the people that run it, the face of it, to do their job. Yep. I've got no business being in their face about it. They know me and I know them, and I walk around the workshop and talk shit with them, as you do, and as you should do, because it's motorsport. It's all about talking shit.
It is. So I got over 200 episodes of proof.
Exactly right.
This year's the end of the era for the current cars. Gen 3 comes on board next year.
Yeah.
Any chance you could have a little steer before? Have you had a steer of one of your team's cars before?
No,
I think you're going to have a go at the end of the year.
We're keeping a couple, I think. I've never... That's the other thing I've never had the desire to do, because there's two reasons. One, I'd probably end up coming off looking like a complete plonker. And secondly, I have too much respect for the gear itself, because I would absolutely mash it, I'm sure. Look, I think it's – I actually have had a drive of a car. I once bought an old ex-Larry car that was a – it was – when I bought it, it was a VS, but it was a VP Castrol car, and it featured it. Featured at Bathurst once, and I thought I'll do some sort of little ride day business, and I had a go of it at Calder, and that sort of cured me, because it was a pretty raw bit of gear, and the Larry Tower got really hot. You know, it was like
the Tower of Power.
The Tower of Power.
With all the buttons.
With all the buttons, none of which I knew, and which I was very much instructed, don't touch the bloody things. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind a steer, but, you know, when the only opportunity you would get to do that is, for instance, if there's a test.
No, ride day. End of the year ride day. Just don't put anyone in for the ride.
Yeah.
Because you're going for the ride.
Yeah, except there'll be people with cameras and, you know, it'll just, you know, what it's all about.
Yeah,
no, I think I'd like to one day. It's not a burning passion. I still go racing, and I've got a race car or race cars that I get that out on. But, you know, frankly, I know how to drive Porsches. The guys that do that, they know how to drive it. Am I curious about it? Yes. But I know that they'll look at the data, and
they've got content for years.
100%. Look at the Bosco, talks a good game.
Stick to the legal profession, mate. 100%. Stick to the legal.
That's the answer.
Have you ever found yourself in a situation? Do you act for other supercar teams?
Yep.
Is that tricky sometimes?
No. I've had a couple of conflict situations arise involving teams and drivers that I've helped in the past, primarily drivers. But no, the other teams that I've acted for and still do from time to time, I say to them, look, you're okay. And it's actually a really important and quite sounds crazy, but wonderful part of what I've been able to achieve, and that is that somebody who's a rival team owner, talking about Betty and, you know, and others, you know, did some work for Techno, that they trust me enough that I will see the inner deals.
But all the numbers, all the details, because as a lawyer,
sometimes a couple of times I said, look, I need to see this driver contract, but I want you to blot out
anything that
I shouldn't see, because I can't unsee it. Yep. And if something happens in the future, I do not want you to think that, you know, that bit of information was a useful bit of information. Look, driver contracts and sponsor contracts are pretty much of a muchness. The guts of them are all the same. The boilerplate's all the same. Ultimately, it's about the financial aspects of the deal and its duration. So I have said, look, I'll need to see XYZ's driver contract, blot out the term, blot out the renewal options, blot out the numbers, because all I need to see is what I'm talking about. But I think it's good. It's good, and it's gratifying that other team owners trust me enough to do that for them, right down to helping them sell or buy teams or wrecks or, you know, teams racing charters, they're called now.
I've got to get my head around that.
TRCs. It's easier to say.
Wrecks. Franchises.
Wrecks. But, again, that's an example. It's a very curious structure that that Supercars operates in. It's a very interesting amalgam of franchising and licences, and particularly when the previous ownership was some team, some Archer. So, no is the answer. The only conflict that can arise is one where you don't maintain your integrity, and and you talk out of school, and I don't, and others know that.
And if you did, you would have been found out by now.
100%. And look, I'm sure that that also prevents some people coming to me because they don't know me, and I don't criticise them for that. So there's work that I won't get because people perceive, actually, you know, you're an owner of Tickford and therefore I don't want you to see the inner workings. But I still do a lot of work for Carrera Cup teams, Super 2 teams, all the drivers that go around with the sponsors, suppliers, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, there's plenty to do. And frankly, at that sort of level where there's buying and selling of teams or teams and teams racing charters, that doesn't happen that much. It's a pretty tightly held business now, because people understand it's incredibly valuable, it's important, you shouldn't turn it over. Everyone that owns a team now is in, my perspective anyway, is in there for the long haul. There's no journeyman. You know, there's people that have come in and made it better and improved it or changed it, but, yeah, it's not a regular market. So
it's a different world. It's
100%. And the new car presents all sorts of challenges and opportunities, but it's part of a natural progression. The current cars then go down to Super 2 teams. You know, team like Tickford, we've got massive capability with engine shops and pre-preg and fab and the machine shop. So that all subsides a little bit more, but that's part of the future. We're repurposing that capability and providing services, and a lot of our old cars are out there, so we still provide, you know, backup and engineering for them.
Could you move, because the nature of Gen 3, with the way that the cars are going to be, the engine suppliers are it's a single source for each side of the fence.
Yeah.
Some of the things that you would normally do for yourself, you can't do for yourself in that world. So how are you going to repurpose those capabilities? I mean, customer work for other types of racing, you're going to build other cars, you're going to run other cars, anything and everything to keep all those people in a gig.
Well, look, all of that at the end of the day, Tickford's exploring some other categories, but those cars do find a home. And so those people need support services, certainly probably from the, not the development side, but from the support side, so parts, engine rebuilds that they can do or don't want to do, you know, dampers, anything that they need built, we can still do. If they want to do some development, we've got a great engineering team. So as far as Tickford's concerned, the composition and structure and the people in it are going to stay the same. There's not going to be any changes of a wholesale nature. We're not going to close down whole divisions. It's important that, you know, if you're going to look at it from a business point of view, and that's where I have probably a little bit more input, Let's maintain the talent. Let's maintain it, but let's reset it into other markets that exist, or markets that we can create, or tell people that we can actually do this. And it doesn't matter. For instance, we're looking at on from the engineering and fabricating side of things. There's government work. You'd think it's got nothing to do with motorsport, but it's got everything to do with engineering. So when you pair it back, Tickford, like the bigger teams, it's actually an engineering business that goes racing. So, and racing will always be the majority and the important part of what we do. But there's a lot of work and a lot of talent that can now be redeployed and will be to the people that we sell cars to, the people that want to come to us. But as I said, there's a whole lot of talent and ability to build things which may never appear on a race car, could appear on a tank. Could appear on an aeroplane.
Could be anywhere.
Could be anything.
Yeah.
Could appear on my car.
Could make it go slow.
Yeah. If I've got something to do with it, it's definitely going to go slower.
Without obviously divulging any secrets. We talked about some of the things that you've been involved in, you know, selling of some of those teams. The Dave Reynolds scenario was well publicised at the time. What are some of the other cases or things that people will have probably read in the motorsport magazines over the journey that you've been involved in and had proximity to?
A lot of the stuff that I do doesn't actually gain notoriety. You know, when the last sale I was involved in, no one knows or knew. If you're in the industry, you knew because, you know, that's gossip.
And if you listen to this podcast, you now know if you didn't know before.
Gossip's like buggery, right? I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's and that's one of the great reasons, you know, you just know about all sorts of things, some of which is true. But the most of what I do is actually very much off the radar. Nothing springs to mind. If I had to think about it, I'm sure I could come up with examples, but from my point of view, it's actually not important about how noticed something that I've done is.
It's probably better that it isn't.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like umpires in football.
Yeah.
If they're doing a really good job, you just don't notice.
100%. It's a sort of perhaps a little bit alike what my picture is in Tickford. I'm in the background. What I do is important to the business, but no one needs to see it. I don't need anyone to see it. But if I'm involved in something that involves a team or a driver or a sponsor or anything to do with that, industry generally knows, but I don't talk about it. I'm actually not there for the notoriety. I'm actually there because I think motorsport is a terrific business and it's a massive passion. So I'm able to allow them to intersect and then do what I do, which is a really good thing about having done it for so long. I get to be able to choose what I do and clients and people support me.
Tell me about your racing. We talked before a little bit about how you got into starting to do some club stuff. Where did it evolve from? And it's been pretty much Porsches the whole time with the odd little deviation off to TCM, Mustang and stuff like that. But tell me, what was the evolution, like sprints with the Porsche Car Club, Porsche Drivers Challenge, which kind of was what Porsche Cup had been.
It was Porsche Cup.
Previously under a new banner.
Yep.
And then it all starts really rolling.
Yeah, 2005, it all happened at Winton, actually. I was up there, bought a new GT3. I'd got rid of my older Porsche and bought a newish GT3. It was James Condouris' old Nations Cup car.
Oh, I remember that. Was it the grey silver Superbarn car?
Yeah, that's right. Which is great because I raced against him once and passed him in his old car.
In his new car.
At Phillip Island. I still remember I passed him going through down into Honda. It was so good. Anyway, so how did I get in? So I was at Winton. It was a bleak winter's day. I was there with Ray Dick, who was helping me out, and there was Mick Ritter testing Formula Fords, and he sort of stopped by and said g'day to Ray, because Ray worked with him at the time. And anyway, Ray a few weeks later goes, look, Mick's thinking about getting into it, and he thought, yeah, you seem to go all right. So I went to see Mick, and it was like a job interview. So what do you want to do, Sven? Oh, I want to go racing. Well, it's not the right answer, you know, Mick. No, seriously, what are you here for? And it was, well, Mick, I sort of want to go faster. Yeah, but why do you want to go faster? God, seriously, I'm about to throw copious amounts of money at you if you let me drive with you. he goes, so try again. Oh, well, look, actually, I want to win. He goes, now we're on it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
So the journey started with Mick, and so he and the people that he drove for him at the time taught me how to drive. So I went, I did GTs for a couple of years, had a great amount of fun. 2007, did all right. And then in 2008, when Carrera Cup stopped. A mate of mine and I had the idea, well, there was a bit of a hole for Porsche there. So we approached them and said, how about you do this GT3 Cup Challenge thing? And look, it was completely self-interested. I needed somewhere to race. So what do? You create a race series.
Make a series.
100%.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. So I did a deal with Marty Wagg because he owned the rights and the category management agreement to Porsche Drivers Challenge. So, and Marty was terrific about it. He knew that it wasn't a natural fit for GTs. And so we did that for 3 years and built it. We had the idea in January 2008. By May 2008, we had 13 cars on the grid at Malala, which is how I met Krause because he helped out.
It's all his fault.
It's all his fault. And so during that time, I just I learned how to drive. So the people that taught me how to drive, Dave.
Reynolds.
Tim Blanchard, Moff, Slade. Who else was there? Percat. All those guys. And, you know, they'd come racing on the weekend and they'd be on the radio. You know, I've great memories of Moff talking to me on the radio saying, Mick Needs says you need to go faster, mate. And I go, well, I'm giving it everything I can. He says, well, I don't think he believes that, so better go faster.
I'm guessing there were some other words in among there.
Oh, there were some glorious experiences with Mick. Mick is one of the most accomplished psychologists on earth, in my view.
He just doesn't have a degree.
He doesn't have a degree. And so I learned everything I know about. I actually watched him, how he ran his race team. That was a big education. So how did I get into motorsport? I saw how Mick ran a race team and how he dealt with his drivers and how it all worked. And being a category owner for the Sprint Challenge or Cup Challenge, as it was, gave me a first-hand experience. So the journey with Porsche was always there. And again, comes back to mum stealing her boss's Porsche back in the late 60s.
Borrowing, Sven.
Yeah, she completely misled him, lied her guts out, I should say. So I had the fun of being taught how to drive. So, for instance, you know, my data would be laid over with Dave's, and my objective was to try and get within a second and a half of his times, wherever it was. I had one memorable time at Bathurst where I was really good up in Sector 1, pretty much only a tenth off him. I was fantastic, about 2/10 in Sector 3, and I was the lazy 8 seconds off in
over
Sector
the top.
2. Funny that, Aaron.
Yeah, yeah. So for Segment 1, up the hill. Sector 3, down the hill.
Yep.
Sector 2, across the hill.
100%. Oh. And it got me to understand that I've got an incredibly talented right foot but no balls.
Well, so 8 seconds worth is...
No, it's massive. But so, yeah, it's been Porsches and then through Cup cars. And then I stopped and did historics. So I bought an old Porsche and made it go fast and did historic racing for a few years. And now I've bought myself an old 2002 or 2004 RSR Le Mans car, which
I wanted to ask you about that. Well, it raced in the Le Mans 24 Hour.
No, it's a Le Mans spec car, but it's raced at Sebring, Monza.
In the series of those races.
Yeah, yeah. It was owned by a bloke like me, so, you know, had the ability to buy one, probably not the ability to drive one. So it had some good drivers at the start, but it's a very cool car, very hard to drive, makes all the right noises. So I bought it because I thought, you know, maybe one day I'll do when I'll put it in a container and have a holiday and bring a mate over and race over there in the historics that they can do. And I've just recently bought a 2009 Cup S, which is a bit of a weapon. So,
so they were the Australian GT sort of car of choice, weren't they? Like 09, 10 sort of. David Wall had one.
And, yeah, Max Twigg. Yeah. Actually, the car that I bought is Maxi Twigg's that won the Grand Prix in 2010.
That's not the one that launched off the back of Peter Hackett in that Lambo, was it? A different one.
Off the start line?
At Sandown.
Not according to the logbook, but I'll check it now, Aaron.
Sorry to bring that. It's only in my brain because we ran that video on our socials about a month and a half ago of I think it was Sandown 2010 because I remember it because I was commentating it. First lap of the GT race at Sandown, into turn two, Peter Hackett is in the Lamborghini, Twiggy's in his Porsche, and he goes over the back of this Lamborghini.
Oh, dear.
I'm hoping for your sake it's a different car, quietly.
I had it looked at.
I'm sure it's in good nick now.
Yeah, well, you know what the logbooks say. They never lie.
They tell all the story, don't they?
So, yeah, that's great. I'm really glad we spoke, Aaron. but that's the car. And so I do state race series now. I went and raced nationally for a long time. And then the Touring Car Masters thing was a great fun thing. I'm great mates with Chris Stilwell, who's now the chairman of Tickford. Mm. So Chris, it was a year when I think you could share the car.
And you both got the points towards the title.
And we both got the points towards the title. And so Chris rings me up and says, look, I'm going to do a bit of travelling this year. I'm going to race in the States. So do you want to share the car? And I said, am I paying? He goes, no. I said, well, of course I'll drive.
I'm in.
And so we shared that and had a good result. We won, I think, the Pro Sport, I think. Or,
I think that's what I think it was called, Pro Sport. Yeah, yeah.
And that was good fun. Launching that thing down Conrod the first time was very character building because, you know, a couple of Hail Marys through the chase and then pulling it up with, you know, brakes the size of dessert plates and, you know, let's just say I used a lot of engine braking pulling that old girl up. But so that – and that was great fun, actually. I was actually quite curious to see whether or not I could drive something other than a Porsche half reasonably, and it turns out I could.
Is it the only thing you've done non-Porsche?
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't think of anything else.
No. If I do something else, I might do it not well. And so just stick to what I know, Aaron.
Stick to what your weakness is. Porsches are your thing.
Yeah.
We'd be worried if you suddenly appeared in something else. You're thinking, what's going on here? This is a little strange.
Yeah, you know, experimentation's all right, but, you know, you've just got to stick with what you know. It's probably being lazy in my racing that I haven't looked at other things, but I know them. You know, I got to the point where because as you race, you have a lot of accidents at times when and they're never of your own doing. But I got to the point where I could actually quote the repair bill about 2 minutes after I looked at it, particularly off the pit wall. So
that's not a good skill set to have acquired.
No, well, we wrote that silver car off at Simmons Plains in 2007 I got turned around and bounced off the Armco in the wall and, you know, it was a classic race, a classic footage with the wheel rolling down the road, and I got out and it was on its guts and the front was stove into the firewall, the back did not resemble a car. And I'm still connected. I connected myself back to the radio because Mick's yelling at me. What are you doing? And I said, I've had a bit of a moment after turn three. I don't think it'll polish out. And, we had to drag that thing back into the transporter. But it's an example. I just know the cars and I enjoy the cars. And they're pretty tricky to drive. So when you get it right, it's very satisfying.
I love your Porsche, we call it sort of the IROC Porsche, the one that you did a bit of TCM in, where you were taking it up to the V8s. I think that's my favourite Porsche of that era that you've raced. Is that one of your favourites?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I just sold that car, actually, because it was going to sit in the corner and do nothing, and that was not right for that car. So,
are we going to see it back?
No, it's in New Zealand.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's in New Zealand. You let them get one. Oh.
Well, I bought my Cup S out of New Zealand, so I took one and gave one back. But,
that's not bad.
That is a fun car. And the reason I mean, I could have gone and got a TCM car, but I enjoyed, you know, particularly on the short tracks, you know, I enjoyed bringing it up to them and driving fast. So, at Winton, it was always I could end up qualifying P5 at best and scaring the shit out of them and, all those being scared, the start of a TCM race when you're surrounded by 24 cars with 700 horsepower and you are about a foot and a half lower than them and they don't look where they are going other than forward, that's just terrifying. The flag goes down and the noise goes up and I'm just shitting a brick and waiting to get hit. But luckily I'm always at the back so that the
– you are not always
mostly, but – so the IROC car is fantastic. It's a very cool 70s wide body, loud. It's sort of the quintessential poster Porsche for people of my vintage growing up. And so I enjoyed developing that car and spending much more money on it than I should. But sort of tying it back to what I do, it's important, I think, for credibility to not just be working on an industry but also still competing. So I like the fact that I'm still racing and to the odd national meeting and the guys in the race team see me hanging around and give them a bit of a wave as I go past and, you know, it's not Rod. He never comes and watches me race. But that's okay. we're still working on that.
One day.
He looks at Nats off but only the next day and goes, oh, well done, mate. Like, seriously, how about on the day?
That's camaraderie. That's camaraderie.
Yeah, Rod's a great bloke.
What's your standout race win? Or I know you won the GT3 Cup Challenge, which is now the Sprint Challenge for those wondering, which I think we've referenced. You got a favourite race? That you won? Didn't you win one of those GT 1 hour races up at Ipswich with Reynolds?
That is the one. No, so that was the in 2006 the GT Endurance Championship, and there were three. So the three 1 hour. 1 hour. was it that year? I think that they, we had a 500K race at the end of the year.
At Sandown.
Yeah, at Sandown.
It might have been 07.
That might have been 07, yeah.
It was around that
But anyway,
time.
I yeah. did that. So Reynolds and I shared at the island and...
And this was in a GD3 cup.
No, this was in my silver thing that, yeah, I, right. that I tailed yep. up. So yep. it must have been 2006. Anyway. Yes,
2000 something.
It was 2006 because I wrecked the car in 2007. So anyway, we did this. So yes, the Ipswich race was my absolute favourite because it was actually Reynolds was at Sandown doing Carrera Cup down with Mick, and I was up there with Ray Dick, who I spoke about earlier. So went up there with Ray and a couple of mates. That's sort of how we did it, and it was all properly done. And so we did the race and. Cricky was there in his Viper and there was Ferraris and all sorts of corruption hanging around. And
spoken like such a Porsche fan. Oh, the word Ferrari gets mentioned.
And, yeah, but very much in low tones. No, I think they're a great car for those that love them. And but so I don't know where I qualified, to be honest. It's somewhere. And so we had a bit of a plan and Ray was really good. He said, right, we're coming in at 39 minutes and putting down tyres down the working side. Yeah, cool, no worries, Ray. So I'm racing around. It was a pretty hot day, as it was in Queensland. And but what happened early was Cricky blew a rear tyre. So he was like three laps down. I thought, oh, beauty, I've made up a spot, you know, pure racer. Yeah, don't do it on the track. Watch someone else's misfortune. And but anyway, a few things happened. And it got to the 39-minute mark, came in, put the working side on. I think I was fourth because some people had pitted, popped back out in sixth and then went for it. And by that stage, the people in front of me were Bryce Washington, the two Conduras boys, and one other. And anyway, I was picking them off it was the only time in my life that I properly hydrated, so I started drinking lots of water on Thursday, whereas some others thought that, you know, a litre 3 hours before the race was a great way to hydrate. And there were people that came off and literally went on drips.
If the race was on Tuesday, maybe that would have
100%. But the people came off that on drips. They came off on drips when we were in Parc Fermé. So anyway, I banged around and I was pulling moves on turn three, and Ray was great. I says, yeah, just quietly be decisive, and blah, blah, blah. Apparently off the radio was, fuck, jeez, don't do that, not there. But nice ones then on the radio to me. And anyway, I passed them with, I don't know, seven laps to go. And, of course, at that point the car made every noise that was never there that I heard. So I thought the gearbox was breaking, I'd lost brakes, you know, looked at the fuel gauge, I was going to run out. And Ray's just going, just drive the bloody thing, eyes forward, I'll tell you if there's anything behind. So the last two laps were great fun. And I remember this is one of the most wonderful things that anyone has ever said to me over the radio. Coming down through turn six, he says, Sven, look up, look at the flag and remember this, you've just won a national level race. And so that's my favourite race because I was there with Ray and who was there with me right at the start. But also just that's to me the sentiment of racing.
Mm.
Look up, you've won something really cool, remember it, enjoy it.
Mm.
And I can tell you that doesn't matter if you're a Formula One driver or you're doing a club thing, the feeling to that driver and to that team and the people who support them is exactly the same. I see it when I'm in the pits at Tickford. I see it when I see it on the telly with other teams. That raw enthusiasm, passion, joy is part of motorsport, and that's what makes it special. Like any sport, I suppose.
Did Mick give you an accolade that weekend or not? Because if he didn't give you one, then he's never going to give you one.
So here's how it went.
All right, here we go.
He's down at Sandown. We've got the result. Ray goes, we've got to call Mick, and we'd heard that David won. So we rang Mick up, we're on speaker, and how'd you go? Yeah, did all right. Yeah, we won. Silence.
Bullshit.
No, we did. Don't bullshit me. And he said, no, Mick, we won. He goes, dropped the F-bomb a few times. But, yeah, he was pleased. Mick's a sort of bloke, and those that have raced with him or know him, if you get a good job, out of him at the end of a race, that's huge.
Mm.
That is huge. And there's some cracker lines. So I think you might have seen that YouTube video back in the day when all the drivers were talking about Mick and his driver coaching, and he'd sort of stick his head in, and you the steam and corruption coming out of your car, and you think you're doing a good job, and he opens the door and he looks and goes, what are you doing? Look, seriously, mate, how hard can it be? You pee nowhere, get out there and do it again. Like, that's Mick the psychologist.
Mental management 101.
100%. And the lies that they tell you over the radio. You're 2 seconds behind when you're like a second in front. So don't slow down because someone's coming and I'll lie to you. That's so. Yeah, lies in motorsport. Who'd have thought?
Shock horror. Holy heck. Holy heck. We talk about Porsches. What's your favourite?
My favourite Porsche is a 1973 911E, which was the first one that I did up, and my kids grew up in the back of it.
Mm.
So it's got the best memories of my Porsches. But my favourite race car, I'd say it's the RSR just because, you know, Porsche looked at it and go, let's just bolt really wide guards on it, stuff the biggest motor we can in it. Like it's just as a car, it's an 11 out of 10 in the scheme of things. It's just big and ugly and fast and raw. So, I like it when it's a bit hard to drive. But the true Porsche is my 73, which the kids were in and still now cannot get in the back of.
I know. Be worried if they could fit.
Yeah.
One of our friends is the motorsporttrader.com. They deal in all sorts of motorsport memorabilia and bits and pieces. This is the way that we segue into the next part of this. But if you're interested to our listeners, head to their website, themotorsporttrader.com. Are you a memorabilia keeper? Have you got something cool or some things cool that you keep or that you've got tucked away or that you keep an eye out for, or you're not really a collector? I always like to ask this of anyone I sit down with.
I don't. I don't do that. I've got my trophies, which is nice, but they're sort of back on a shelf. But, no, I'm not a memorabilia collector. I take a pretty workmanlike approach to motorsport stuff, and it's a tool for me. So, you know, some people want to buy a certain race car driver's helmet. I've got a helmet and I've got an old one. And so I keep my old helmets. I'll say that, but it's not memorabilia. That's just me.
It's got to go somewhere.
But no, I don't do memorabilia at all. But I think they're great things because they also, every bit of memorabilia comes with a story.
Mm.
And it's actually the story that's more important than the item itself.
Most of the time in my experience, that's exactly the case. Where
about
it was found, how it got to be, where it ended up being.
Yep.
Someone was going to throw it out, kept it, went through 9,000 different people's hands, all that sort of stuff.
And here it is.
It's pretty cool. It tells its own story.
That's it.
We've got a couple of National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions from our listeners and our social readers. You're looking at me like this could – normally – our guests have had a look at these on socials before.
I don't do socials, you see.
Well, that's good because you can't preempt anything.
No,
here, so.
No, I can barely work my messages. So fire away.
All clear. Liam Briggs, when we did the call out, he wanted to know about the Tickford Road Car business. Of course, Tickford Racing's the supercars team that we've discussed at length. But what was the process in bringing Tickford back to the automotive market in Australia, and how did you get the rights to the Tickford name he's interested in?
So I'll start with the rights. Well, we were looking for – so why to go auto? Because it was something that FBR had done and done very well. And there was a hole in the market. We thought that vehicle enhancement, and we think that vehicle enhancement is really important. So FBR done a very good job on it, and a lot of FBR people are still there. So it was also a natural extension of trying to diversify the Tickford business. We had a chat amongst ourselves and identified what Mustang in particular was coming up, but the Ranger, which is a terrific car, and other Ford products. So we thought vehicle enhancement is good, and we've done nearly 4,000 cars on the journey now. So it was an extension of the race team and a way also to promote the brand. And so Tickford, we had ProDrive, which is obviously well known, but we wanted something of our own. And so we'd paid ProDrive to use the name. But Tickford, we did a little bit of a workshop and it came up as an old Ford name. So being the lawyer, I did a trademark search. And back when Ford had decided to shrink its operations, they'd basically let go of all their trademarks. So I saw the Tickford one and it was well known. So I thought, I'll buy that. I'll register it because it was deregistered. And so that's how we got it.
Mm.
It came up as part of the workshop, you know, the old butcher's paper and stuff. But it was opportunistic because I couldn't believe that it was still there, able to be appropriated, and we got it.
Mm. So with these things, if people let something lapse, anyone can go and grab it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Oh, look, there will be restrictions, particularly if it's still closely aligned with somebody else's product. You can't really allow yourself to have the mark confused. But yes, theoretically, a lapsed mark can be picked up by someone else.
Lucky I registered V8 Sleuth all those years ago.
Oh, too. Yeah, no. Mm. Look, I'm sure it was somewhere in the 80s.
I was about three.
Yeah.
Stuart Rutherford's got an interesting question too. Why did Tickford keep with the four-car program? And he feels the best performing teams have two. What's the theory? Because you guys have had that for quite a long time over the journey.
Yeah, I think it depends what you talk about, how you define performance, right? So a race team's got to perform, obviously, on the track. But equally, it's got to perform off the track. And it's a function of the infrastructure that we had. We've actually modelled a two-car team. And with our infrastructure and what we have, it's actually a backward step because from a business point of view, you can apply economies of scale across four cars. The other thing is from a team's championship point of view, more cars equals more opportunity to accumulate points. The other thing is we've got sponsors that want to be associated with us. And so as a business, you have to give them the high-speed billboard and all the things that go with it. So we've explored at smaller teams. I think so performance is also off-track financial viability. And sure, you look at the teams that we're currently racing against, and they're doing great things. But frankly, so are we.
Mm.
You know, just you look at the last weekend just gone. We had some terrible luck. You know, poor old JC got punted. But you know, your Cam outstanding running, but Jake is sticky. I mean, what a great story that is.
Fast in Darwin, got in the shootout.
Like seriously, yeah. it was absolutely killing a pig. And you don't actually get the opportunity to accommodate younger drivers in a narrower team. And that's why we run Super 2 as well, because it's always a great, you know, we had the Super 2, Zach there on the weekend and, you know, did what he did, but that he was there to learn. So we look at our business more holistically than, you know, what's the most efficient way to win races. We absolutely do that, everything that we do. And all those four cars are all the same. Pretty much, you know, the engineers tune them and make them adjust to what they think. But a four-car team is viable and important for the way in which we want to run the business, and it gives us more opportunity to win.
Mm. And winning is good.
Winning is good. Mm. Winning is good. Mm. Feels great.
Just quickly before we wrap up,
yep.
Gen 3, the future of supercars. How do you know, you've got skin in the game.
Yeah.
How do you feel? I mean, there's been an ownership change as well.
Yeah.
Are you buoyant about the future? What are the challenges that lie ahead in the next 12 to 24 months?
The first challenge is actually building the bloody things because just as we went through with Blueprint and Car of the Future, every time there's a change of the underlying car, there's a lot of disruption and particularly in our business, but everyone who runs current cars is in the same thing. They're having to race a car, but they're also having to build and develop or access and buy a car, if that's the sort of team you are. So the main challenge now is getting these things built, and it's a massive financial challenge. And supercars, the new owners, have come to the party and done really great things to support the teams. There's a lot of angst about will it get done in time. The answer is race teams always get it done.
Always find a way.
Yeah, I mean, you look at JC's car on the weekend.
I thought you would have dug a deep hole,
shoved it in and backfilled it. But an hour and a half later, it was back racing. You know, it wasn't the best race car on earth. And as Tim said, it looked pretty ugly underneath. But so a race team's ability to get stuff done, particularly ours, I know our guys, they'll be tired as all get out. They'll be burning the mid-oil. There'll be spanners flying around this workshop, but they'll get them built. I think that Gen 3 conceptually is a really good thing because it also does things like control costs, which are rampant and out of control. And it's, you know, it is a bit of economic warfare, which is a challenge because it prevents people from coming into the competition as easily as they could. So I think that the other good thing about Gen 3 is it will make the drivers shine. will show who a little bit more. Because that does come down to gear. And we've got good gear, and a few people have, they've all got good gear. It's just how to make them go fast. So I think there's that. I think control engines, crate engines, and all the spec stuff. I mean, there's a lot of spec stuff on the current cars. There is, but you know, they're difficult to build, difficult to maintain. If you saw underneath our cars, to make them fit onto the current substructure, the amount of bracketry and other stuff, that all goes. So it's an easier...
All the fiddly stuff.
It's easier car to make, easier car to maintain. So the main challenge, I don't think acceptance by the market's going to be a problem. They're going to sound good. They look great. They'll all be fast. The aero, as I think Frosty and even JC said, it'll suit those drivers of more experience because they're going to be a more mechanically grip car than they are now, which is a fair bit of aero involved. So I think it'll make for a good show. The new owners of supercars are terrific. I think that is really bright. Certainly Rod and I's, our view is that the future of supercars couldn't be better right now. It's probably the best place it's in to go forward.
Look forward to seeing how it all goes forward and how many more races Tickford can get up to. You're not far off 100. You're getting closer. You're getting closer. There's cupcakes ahead for 100 wins.
Or bottles.
Oh, yeah. Either or. There's a party of some kind. Sven, great to sit down. Thank you so much for the insight into what you do, your involvement with Tickford, with the Porsche stuff. Some great stories in there. And do I get billed by the 6-minute block for this podcast, or how does this work?
Well, look, you haven't got anything on with me at the moment, but I do keep a note. So when you do come back, I've enjoyed the time. If there's anything I enjoy, is talking about myself. And this would give me a great opportunity.
Goal achieved. Just here to help. Thanks, Sven.
Thanks, Aaron.
There you have it, Sven Burkhartz. Now you know a little bit more about the co-owner of Tickford Racing. And I should point out too, we did this chat in the week after Darwin. So some of those references about this weekend and so on with Zach Best, that was referring to Hidden Valley Darwin, because that was the week in which we were certainly speaking. Now, before I go, a thing that Sven is heavily involved in, I want to mention this because it's pretty cool, Stuttfest. It's an all things Porsche motoring festival. It's at Winton, August 26th to 28th. Visit the website stuttfest.com.au for some more details. If you love your Porsches, that's going to be a really cool event with racing on track, car displays, plenty of stuff. It's going to be really good. If you like Porsches, it's something that you need to get along to. Well, that's us done. Hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Don't forget, you can like, subscribe, and review our work wherever that you think you need to do it, wherever you listen to it, wherever you want to provide it. We love to hear from you. Next week on the V8 Sleuth podcast, I've got a really special guest. He is the host of the biggest, most listened to sports podcast in Australia, Mark Howard. Howie, of course, the Howie Games. Longtime motorsport guy too. Worked with Network 10 in the 2000s with Trackside and their V8 Supercar telecast. A lot of people don't know that Howie's whole sporting media career, which by the way now is booting goals with Fox with its cricket and AFL coverage, began as a rigger for Formula One, for Formula One management in Grand Prix in the late 90s. So it's a great chat. I really thoroughly enjoyed catching up with Howie. That's my guest and episode next Wednesday on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Of course, every Tuesday, the Castrol Motorsport News podcast with Stefan Bartholomaeus and Andrew Van Leeuwen with all the latest and greatest of news, notes and quotes. And of course, Repco Supercars Weekly every Thursday or Friday. Tune in for it. That's why you need to subscribe. So we don't know every week what day that's going to roll out. Depends on the news, depends on what's happening around the place. But if you subscribe via Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts, you get the notification, so you'll always know when the next episode will be. Anyway, that's me done. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. I'm Aaron Noonan, and I'll chat to you again next week.